This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, January 8th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with the reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll hear from Mike Dean at the State House and CAI's Eve Zuckoff. And now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. As we continue to see a surge in COVID-19 cases, separate recovery facilities may prove critical in relieving the pressure on hospitals. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with this story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Glad to be here.
Jeanette, sometimes these are called step-down facilities, as the care is a step down from the more intense care one might receive at a hospital. This week, you reported that the Cape delegation put a request into the state to open one of these step-down facilities, but that it hasn't gone anywhere yet. Tell us about this.
Right. Well, it looks like for the moment, the Cape isn't getting a step-down unit. And I'll tell you a little bit about how that happened. So, yes, eight legislators sent a letter to the state in mid-December asking for something that was a requirement, which is a license extension in order for Cape Cod Healthcare to reopen a step-down unit at what used to be the Royal Falmouth Nursing Home. And they had opened that in the spring for the same purpose as a COVID step-down unit. The legislators didn't hear back until this Wednesday, when the state said it would extend the license, but it wouldn't provide the same funding for standalone step-down units as it had provided before. So instead, the hospital would have to apply for money for a dedicated wing or unit. That was the state's response. And I'm reporting here, actually, for the first time that I got a statement in, from Mike Loft, the CEO of Cape Cod Healthcare. He says he will not be able to open the step-down unit under those conditions. So in his statement, he thanked the delegation, and then I'll quote here briefly. He said, "Due to staffing and resource constraints, we at CCHC, Cape Cod Healthcare, will be unable to proceed with the application and setup of a step-down unit at this time," unquote. So that's where we stand. Right now, no unit.
So this was a unit that, as you say, was opened in the spring when it seemed like we really would, there was a possibility there would be so much pressure on the hospitals they would need to be able to sort of have an overflow site where people could receive this recovery care. Right now, the hospitals, as we're going to hear, are facing a lot of cases. We're in probably the biggest surge of the pandemic, and yet this is not happening here on the Cape. That's what you're telling us?
Yes. And it is true that those facilities did not have a lot of patients in the spring. But the case counts are higher now, so we're going to have to see where this goes. I don't know if Cape Cod Healthcare has an alternative plan.
You also reported this week that New Bedford has managed to thread this needle, and they're going to be opening a step-down facility. Tell us about this.
Yes. They have leased a facility. It's actually, they leased two in the spring for the same kind of situation and retained control of it this whole time. So they're reopening the larger one, which is 123 beds. It's way up at the northern tip of New Bedford, and it's supposed to open on the 18th of January. I'm not sure about, you know, whether this response the state gave to Cape Cod Healthcare about a standalone unit, how that applies to New Bedford. But the mayor of New Bedford says the cost of the lease itself and some renovations they had to do are supposed to be federally reimbursed, and then the city is contracting with a nursing home management company to run this step-down unit.
Give us an update on the COVID situation right now on the Cape. We continue to see some very high numbers.
Yes, the case counts are climbing on the Cape. A little bit of good news, Vera Harik of the Barnstable County Department of Human Services says rate of new cases per 100,000 people has stabilized on the Cape, but the rate actually continues to rise in Dukes and Nantucket counties. And she says transmission within the household is far and away the predominant setting for getting a new cluster of COVID-19 cases.
So it's transmission within families, essentially, is what you're saying.
Yes, the state is tracking clusters, and that household category is by far the top category. I believe that is within families. I don't know if it includes, you know, people that you might have in your inner circle, so to speak, that may not be under your roof exactly. But yeah, that sort of close contact transmission is something that people are really focusing on now as a big way that new clusters of cases are happening.
Now, on the Outer Cape, there's been a commitment to testing people who are asymptomatic, and these are folks who maybe feel like they might just have been exposed to somebody with the virus, and the outcome here is notable. Explain this for us.
Yes, Outer Cape Health Services opened this asymptomatic testing about 2 weeks ago, and since then they say about 60% of the positive tests that they're getting are coming from that asymptomatic group. So Patricia Nadel, the CEO, says this is exactly why they wanted to do asymptomatic testing, and it's an important tool there. She says they've gotten state permission also to continue the rapid antigen test through the end of February. That's a test that's not considered quite as accurate as the PCR test, but it does give results in about 15 minutes. It was supposed to end Sunday. Now through the end of February, folks will be able to get the rapid test at Outer Cape Health Services. At their locations, which are in Harwich-Port, Provincetown, and Wellfleet.
Jeanette, also this week, you spoke with the operator of a Cape nursing home about the vaccination process so far for residents and staff. What did you hear?
Yeah, so I talked to Bill Bogdanovich of Broadreach Healthcare, which owns the Victorian and Liberty Commons in Chatham. He says it's going well. He says CVS came on December 29th. Gave the first round of vaccines to most of the people who wanted it. It did take longer than planned, so they were there until 9 o'clock instead of 5. But they're coming back for the second round later this month, and it's essentially going well.
First responders are next in line to get vaccinations. That could start happening early next week. What do we know about how that's going to roll out?
Yeah, so I'm hearing from local officials that many communities around the area are planning to vaccinate their public safety personnel sometime next week. For the Upper Cape in particular, Sandwich is running a big clinic starting on Monday that will do police, fire, and EMS staff from the four towns, Sandwich, Bourne, Falmouth, and Mashpee, plus the fire department from Joint Base Cape Cod. That's all at the Human Services building, but we should note it's not open to the public. Again, this is for first responders, and it's by invitation only.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes updating us on many aspects of the COVID pandemic story. Jeanette, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Steve.
This week, the Cape passed a bleak milestone. More than 250 people have now died from COVID-19. CAI's Sam Houghton has this story and more and joins us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, you spoke to some county officials about this milestone. What are they saying?
Yeah, so over the summer, the number of deaths we were seeing on the Cape was maybe one or two a week. As we got into the fall, that started to creep up a little bit. Then county officials really started to raise the alarm heading into the holidays, Christmas time. We were seeing four or five deaths every 3 days, they were saying. But we've kind of turned a grim corner this week. There were 9 deaths reported on Sunday alone, which is a high for the pandemic. But every day this week, we've seen more deaths than we've really ever seen during this pandemic. Almost 30 Cape residents died this week. So we passed that 250 deaths, I believe, Monday or Tuesday. I did talk to Sean O'Brien. He's the county health director. He said this is really, you know, a critical time. We're still seeing a surge related to Thanksgiving. We're likely going to see a surge from Christmas and New Year's and gatherings from that. But his message was what we've been hearing all along, although maybe with some more urgency now. You know, wear a mask, social distance, get tested if you have even mild symptoms, and really stay home. But O'Brien is remaining, somewhat optimistic here. The vaccine rollout is continuing. We're getting first responders, as we heard, next week. But he says we need to get through these next few months, which are going to be pretty difficult, I think.
Speaking of the vaccine rollout, you have some news this week that the rollout of the vaccine for nurses at Cape Cod Healthcare has been going smoothly so far, too. Tell us about that. What did you hear?
Yeah, I spoke with one of the leaders of the local nurse union, Shannon Sherman. She said that nurses that got the vaccine back in that initial shipment, they've started to get their booster shots this week. Something like 3,000 doses were shipped to Cape Cod Healthcare in mid-December. And Sherman says that from the nurses she's talked to, the rollout has been going well. I think it's pretty interesting, worth mentioning here, the healthcare providers sent out a survey to nurses about their interest in getting the vaccine, whether they would take it or not. And Sherman told me that the results found that 95% of Cape nurses wanted to get the vaccine. So really almost every nurse on the Cape. And this might not be the case everywhere. We heard this morning there could be some resistance on the Vineyard. You might hear later on the show. But I asked her why she thought nurses were so supportive of vaccines. And, there's kind of a number of reasons, really. But for one, they see firsthand how much of an impact this virus has had. Hospitals are filling up. And, as we were just talking about, people are dying. And Sherman says that, nurses do their research and they know this will help them do their jobs better, caring for their patients. She did mention there were, maybe a few minor side effects from the vaccine among the nurses getting them, but nothing major or unexpected.
Sam, the storming of the Capitol by Trump extremists on everyone's mind this week. It's filtered down to local politics. You spoke with a newly sworn-in Republican lawmaker, Stephen Exeros. And I think there was a lot of feeling that this could put Republicans perhaps in a tough position. A lot of people have said that President Trump incited this violence. What was your interview with Exeros like?
Yeah, well, first, he had a lot of emotions seeing the footage we've all likely seen now. He was disgusted, saddened, shocked. Those were some of the words he described to me. He was actually being sworn in for his first term as the state representative. He's representing the 5th Barnstable District. Right around the same time as the rioting began, he was getting sworn in. He actually didn't know what was going on until much later when a reporter asked him how he felt about it outside the state house. But he said it was quite a contrast, going from being sworn in at the state house. He's there with Republicans, new Democrats from around the state, all different races, all pledging to work together. And then you have this, this mob threatening elected officials at the nation's capital. And that was tough for him. But I did press him a little on what this means, politically. Exeros, as some might remember, he attended a Gold Star family dinner hosted by President Trump last year. But his response, I think you'll see this around the state, he did distance himself from the president. He said his relationship isn't based on politics, but about being at that Gold Star family. I did ask him what he thought about President Trump's rhetoric that he might have, instigated some of this violence. And Exeros told me he hadn't heard what the president had said, but he did say that leaders everywhere, from local officials up to President Trump, they really need to come out and condemn this violence and very clearly. That's what he said to me. He also said that, he would accept Joe Biden as the next president and that the country really needs to move forward on that.
We also heard from Congressman Bill Keating, who represents the Cape and Islands, and he was at the Capitol when the extremists broke in. What was his reaction?
Yeah, Keating was actually on his way to the chamber for the hearing to certify Biden as president. So he had a real firsthand experience. They were actually evacuating people into his building, so he had to actually shelter in place there. He was on his Twitter immediately, saying that he and his staff were okay, they were safe. And what I thought was neat, and we've heard this a lot now, but Keating and his fellow lawmakers were defiant. They stayed at the Capitol until it was cleared by security, and then they held the hearing. They finished their business close to 4 in the morning. But yeah, Keating had some strong words for the president. He said he incited these riots and that he needs to be held accountable. And he has since called for the removal of the president through the 25th Amendment, although he said that, you know, that could be difficult with only 2 weeks left in the presidency. But he also, you know, had some interesting things to say about the impacts of the riots on the rest of the world. He says it's, you know, frightened our allies while also emboldening countries like China and Russia.
That is CAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard saw the highest number of single-day positive cases of COVID-19 yet this week. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette is with us now with an update. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Steve.
Noah, you had 16 cases reported Tuesday, 25 on Wednesday, or maybe even more, depending on how you're counting. What can you tell us about this latest uptick?
So on Wednesday, which, you know, as historic events were unfolding nationwide, the island also saw a record, and that was the highest number of cases that it's seen in a day since the pandemic began. I think the previous record was 21, and that was on the last day of 2020. There were 25 positive laboratory confirmed tests, but there were also 5 patients who were symptomatically diagnosed with the virus. And talking to one of the health officials on the island, she said that many of those people had gone in to the emergency room. I mean, that's sort of how when someone is symptomatically diagnosed, it means that a doctor is diagnosing them based upon them showing certain symptoms that are indicative of COVID-19, even though they haven't gotten a positive test. And those are people who were going into the ER. And they weren't admitted to the hospital, but, you know, just shows that, you know, by probably any sort of count, there were 30 people who were positive for COVID-19 newly on Wednesday, which is a fairly large number, the largest since the pandemic began.
For the whole week, you're over 70, is that right?
Yeah, and I think that is also a record for weekly numbers. And beyond all of that, the hospital reported on Tuesday that they had readmitted a patient for COVID-19, and that was the first time that someone had been readmitted with the virus. They're in fair condition, according to the hospital. They classify conditions as either good, fair, serious, or critical. And just because of privacy, they are not disclosing when the person had previously been admitted. But that was sort of a striking development as well.
Let's talk about the vaccine then. You have an article out yesterday kind of taking a look at what the rollout plan might be for the island. What can you tell us?
Everything is still in its first phase. We'd been getting a lot of questions from the public about where sort of the vaccine rollout plan was at. And just talking to health officials here, they're totally mobilizing to be able to roll out something when they do get vaccines for the general public. They just don't have them, and they don't expect to have them at least until April. And even in February, which is when phase two of the states, or at least what Governor Baker is planning for a vaccine rollout, and that would include frontline workers like grocery store workers and sort of larger swath of people, that's not happening until at least February. But right now, the island has administered, I believe it's around 350 doses of vaccine. Those are almost entirely to frontline healthcare workers. So unless you're a frontline healthcare worker, health agents were saying you don't even really consider thinking about the vaccine until February, and that's only if you're over 75, have 2 underlying conditions, or are working, you know, in transportation at a grocery store, sanitation worker, that kind of thing. The island did get 275 doses of vaccine for public safety officials, and the hospital is going to hold clinics to administer those. But that's sort of where they are at right now. And then they're kind of discussing among themselves what the best way to widely administer vaccine is, but they haven't really made any decisions, they're still waiting on the vaccine itself. But it sounds like that they know that they need to be prepared for how to do it when that day actually comes.
They're kind of underscoring how logistically challenging it's going to be as they're looking forward, as they're looking ahead to this, to try to vaccinate every person on the island and do it in an orderly way. Yeah.
Right. It's sort of this complicated thing. I mean, the island had a flu clinic back in the fall, and that was something that the health agents had done before, and they sort of considered it a dress rehearsal for putting out a COVID-19 vaccine. But the thing is, the flu shot is just fundamentally different in a lot of ways than the COVID-19 vaccine. Since the COVID-19 vaccine needs two shots for one. And then also, because no one's ever gotten it before, every person has to wait for 15 minutes to make sure that they don't have an anaphylactic reaction to it, which is actually true of flu vaccines as well. It's just most people have had them before. But that totally complicates how sort of like a drive-in vaccination clinic would work, and it makes it take longer. The other thing is that they're getting two different types of vaccine, and they're going to be getting more different types of vaccine by the time it's generally available to the public. Each one has different storage mechanisms and, you know, requires different like ways that it can be administered. The Moderna vaccine, when you get it, has to be administered immediately. The Pfizer one needs to be stored in a very specific temperature cold storage facility. So they're all sort of trying to figure that out. And then where vaccines come from is different, too. I mean, most are coming from the state. But, for instance, the island's long-term care facility is getting vaccine from a federal program. And so it really is this patchwork of agencies that are having to work together to do it. It sounds like the health agents on the island are on top of it, but it's totally complicated logistically.
So Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
A historic building from Chatham now sits in the town of Hull. But some folks are pushing Chatham to take it back again. If you're a little confused by that, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to help make sense of a fascinating story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, first off, there's a great photo that goes with this story. It's a picture of the building hanging from a crane over a barge. And this is a big building, a substantial building. Before we get into this too far, tell us about the building itself and how it got to Hull and what makes it historic.
Sure. Yeah, this building has a very interesting history. For many years, it sat on the shore of Sage Harbor. It was built by the Coast Guard in 1937 and used as a to store and to haul out their rescue boats, including the famous 36500, the lifeboat that was used in the Pendleton rescue in 1952, which we saw portrayed in the movie The Finest Hours. Fast forward to 2009, the land was privately owned. The boathouse had been decommissioned in the 70s. A new house was going to be built, and the boathouse was going to be demolished. But a group of local residents tried to find a new location for it in town. They failed, but contractor Jay Cashman agreed to lift the boathouse onto a barge and bring it to his boatyard in Quincy. And that's what happened. That's the picture you see on our website. And that the boathouse stayed in Quincy for almost a decade until about 18 months ago. It was moved to a boatyard in Hull, where it was going to be used for storage or other purposes. But the owners of that property failed to get the necessary zoning and conservation permissions from the town of Hull. And there ensued a court battle about removing the boathouse from the shore in Hull. That culminated in October when the boathouse was going to be auctioned to get it off the property. Local resident Dave Doherty, who had spearheaded the efforts a decade ago to find a new location, he found out about that. He went to the owners, reached an agreement to buy the boathouse and take it out of the auction, and with the idea of bringing it back to Chatham. Now, to bring us up to the present, the Chatham selectmen were asked this past Tuesday if they would accept the gift of the boathouse, a donation of it to the town from Doherty and his group in order to find a new use for it in Chatham to bring it back to town. The idea was perhaps it would serve as a new building to house a shellfish upwelling system that the town is planning to install on property along Sage Harbor. Selectmen, however, kind of balked at that idea. They said they didn't have enough information about the cost of this, and they wanted to have assurances that the boathouse would would be able to be used for this purpose. They had an initial engineering assessment, which found that the structure was sound, but it was going to cost in the range of $1 million to transport it to Chatham and renovate it. Now, to update you even further, we just learned this morning that finally the boathouse was actually moved from Hull to Quincy in the early morning hours. So right now it's sitting in Jay Cashman's boatyard. He's agreed to store it for up to 6 months while the town figures out if it wants the boathouse back and what to do with it.
Is there a lot of support within the town to try to recover the boathouse?
There actually is. There's a lot of local preservationists and other residents are anxious to get this structure back to town. They point out that a number of other, at least two other major pieces of Coast Guard history that were associated with the town were lost. The Old Harbor Life Saving Station used to sit on North Beach, but that was taken to Provincetown in the 1970s, and the 36500 lifeboat itself is owned by the Center for Culture and History in Orleans, so that's not even birthed in Chatham anymore. So people are saying, you know, it's time that we save some of the Chatham history and we bring this boathouse back to town and find a use for it.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
The site of the former Lobster Claw restaurant on Route 6A in Orleans could become a multi-million dollar medical facility. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent has this story. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Ed, this would represent a major expansion by Cape Cod Healthcare, which already operates the Cape's two hospitals in Hyannis and Falmouth. Tell us about this project, what we know about it.
Yes, Cape Cod Healthcare is sort of the behemoth in healthcare on Cape Cod and the islands and somewhat beyond. And they're planning a $5.6 million urgent care and primary care center, just where you said, at the old Lobster Claw restaurant, which shut down this year. They're planning to demolish it and put up a new 6,800-square-foot building. And this has big implications for health care on the Outer Cape in particular, which has been served for a very long time by Outer Cape Health Services, which is an independent nonprofit with three clinic locations in Provincetown, Wellfleet, and Harwichport. So it's a major move on the part of Cape Cod Healthcare to this part of the Cape. And it's not clear what the implications will be for the existing organization.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that. As you say, Outer Cape Health is already kind of serving this area. How are they responding to this idea?
Well, they're not really saying much about it. Their spokesperson, Jerry Desitel, would only say the future impact of Cape Cod Healthcare in Orleans remains to be seen. But it's clear that it's going to have an impact. Outer Cape Health, which is well loved by many people out here, has nevertheless struggled to attract and retain especially primary care providers. They're a much smaller organization. Cape Cod Healthcare is approximately 40 times the size of Outer Cape in terms of revenue. And it's hard to attract doctors and other practitioners to this part of the Cape for, you know, many of the same reasons that other rural areas all across the country have that problem. There's a real shortage of primary care providers. But Cape Cod Healthcare has much deeper pockets, can pay higher salaries, can potentially offer better working conditions. In fact, our reporter, the wonderful Christine Legere, interviewed the CEO, Michael Lauff, of Cape Cod Healthcare, who actually said that he thinks physicians want to practice in an environment that's nice and warm and clean and has amenities, meaning cutting-edge facilities and services. So
does that suggest that they don't have that opportunity now? Yeah.
Well, actually, the Outer Cape Health has put a lot of energy into upgrading their facilities. They have a new clinic in Harwichport, and they recently opened a completely rebuilt and renovated one in Wellfleet. But the fact is, they don't offer all kinds of services that they just, you know, they do have urgent care in Provincetown, but they have to send people to the emergency room at Cape Cod Hospital in Hyannis for lots of things that otherwise could be taken care of in a better equipped facility. One of the issues here, Steve, is that Outer Cape Health is a federally qualified rural health center, which Cape Cod Healthcare is not. And what one of the things that means is that Outer Cape is required to serve everyone who walks through the door, whether they have insurance or not, whereas an organization like Cape Cod Healthcare or any private doctor's office has the right to turn people away or to say, you know, we only accept certain kinds of insurance. So that's another issue that will need to be addressed, and that Outer Cape will no doubt be emphasizing in its own efforts to retain, you know, its position here.
We will be following along the story. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Farmers and livestock owners on Martha's Vineyard may rely on hay that comes from the mainland, but that hay has recently gotten much harder to bring to the island. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times has that story. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. Happy New Year.
George, this appears to be the ferry line beginning to enforce a rule that it hadn't previously enforced, and yet nobody at the steamship is sort of coming out and saying just that. Or maybe the rule isn't explicitly written somewhere. It's certainly causing trouble and expense for some people. Explain what's happened here.
Yeah, what we're being told is that the Steamship Authority is following federal guidelines, which say that hay is flammable. And so it has to be transported to the island on an open freight ship, not on one of the other ferries that the SSA runs. Of course, the Island Home and the Martha's Vineyard and some of the other ferries are enclosed areas. And they're saying those are the ones that are restricted. This has not been something that has been enforced in the past. And it's creating a hardship for the supplier, the main supplier for hay on the island. He can't get a reservation on the earliest boats. And so he has to wait around till a mid-afternoon boat. And when he gets to the island and makes his deliveries, by that time, he's at a point where he's required to rest. There are Department of Transportation guidelines for truck drivers. And so he ends up staying overnight on the island, sometimes sleeping in the cab of his truck. I guess truckers are pretty used to that. However, you know, it's creating a money problem. Costing him more money, and it's and in in turn, it's costing the customers more money. And the bottom line is the farmers are saying this was sprung on them. This isn't something that had been happening before. There's been no meeting about it, no memo to them saying that anything about this change. And so it's something the vineyard recently established a farm bureau, and it's something that the farm bureau told us this week that they're going to bring up on the behalf of farmers across the island who rely on this as a source of food for their livestock. You know, this isn't simply bringing in hay for hay sake. This is something that these farmers rely on to keep their livestock alive and well fed.
Hey, you have another article this week I want to ask you about. It's a report of a very interesting discussion in Chilmark, and interesting in part for its subject, but also for its circumspection, for what doesn't get said here. This is about vaccination of first responders. Tell us about this.
Yeah, absolutely. This came up at a selectmen's meeting, and, you know, we've been highlighting the fact that on Monday, first responders will be the next in line to get the vaccine against COVID-19. And the hospital is ramping up, getting ready to start doing that. And then later in the week, they'll have clinics that police officers and firefighters and EMTs can go to. And but at the meeting in Chilmark, there was some pushback by the chiefs, the police chief in Chilmark, Jonathan Claren, and the Tri-Town Ambulance Chief, Bette Rittmeyer, said they're getting pushback from their employees who don't necessarily want to take the vaccine, don't trust it. And so they went before the board to see what the board's position was on this. And the selectmen did not take a vote, sort of strongly encouraged that they want employees in this position to take a vaccine, but didn't come out and enforce it. And listeners may remember several years ago, vaccines were a big issue on the island, where it was one of the highest percentages in the state of unvaccinated children going to the schools, getting religious exemptions in order to not have to vaccinate their children. So it is a big issue on the island, and has been, and that's sort of what's unsaid here, as you opened up with, is there may be people who are anti-vaccine among the staff of the police and fire departments and emergency services on the island.
It's George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Some changes on Beacon Hill this week as lawmakers worked deep into the night to finish up the 191st legislative session before a new one began. And the House did it with a new leader after longtime Speaker Robert DeLeo stepped down. CAI's Catherine Iden talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean for the details. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Mike, lawmakers tried to push through quite a bit this week as they neared the end of the session. That was on Monday and Tuesday, before the next legislative session was gaveled in on Wednesday. I want to start first with an economic development bill that has some pieces related to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is a huge bill, has a lot in it. So talk about some of the highlights.
This was really the biggest thing that the legislature wanted to get done before the end of their session. And between the House and the Senate, they have been negotiating this $625 million plus dollar package since July, when they extended the session out till the end of their session. That's why it was happening this week. The big cornerstone of this is COVID relief, not only for businesses harmed by the pandemic and different shutdowns, but a lot of nonprofits, things like museums, other kind of tourism industry type things that have really been harmed by the pandemic and the shutdowns. One big thing is related to the restaurant industry is that it will finally put a cap on how much these delivery services can charge for meal delivery. And that's something that the restaurant industry has been complaining about this entire time. Now that they rely mostly on takeout and delivery, these apps like DoorDash or Grubhub or, you know, take your pick, they say are charging too much and taking the profit out of what is now an exclusively takeout business from the restaurants. Small business and loan grants, things like that. Another key cornerstone to this thing, though, is housing reform. It would essentially allow cities and towns to create more housing development because it will lower the threshold for approval for these projects. This is something that Governor Baker has been wanting for years and years and years at this point. The legislature's rejected it year after year. They've finally done it. It's his so-called housing choices legislation. One thing that didn't get into this bill because the Senate wanted to wait was the House's proposal to legalize sports gambling. So that would be, you know, professional sports wagering through apps like DraftKings and some other competitors. It would have created that new industry that has been legalized at the federal level. So that is still very much at the front of the agenda. But the way Beacon Hill works, getting to sports wagering could take another, you know, several months to a year.
I want to switch to another huge bill that lawmakers put on the governor's desk this week, and it's what they're calling a roadmap for combating climate change. There are some elements that the governor has said he would agree to, but of course there are pieces of it he may not be that excited about. Tell us the highlights of what this bill is trying to accomplish.
Yeah, it's essentially the big headline here is that the state of Massachusetts would have zero net emissions by 2050. That sounds like the future, but it's less than 30 years away. It does that through a lot of different, you know, roadmaps, so to speak, of how different sectors will reduce their emissions. So, you know, the housing sector will have to do certain kinds of, you know, LEED certifications and energy efficiency. That's how they will get there and play their part. The biggest part here is the transportation sector. Not only are, you know, state-owned vehicles and especially municipal vehicles going to be changed over to electric from gas, it also puts in certain standards to get you and me and regular drivers into electric vehicles over the next several decades. And it will ban the sale of most gas combustion engines in Massachusetts, you know, a generation from now, so to speak. But we will, you know, this will kind of guide the end of the gasoline era and usher in the electricity era. So one thing it does, it sets a bunch of benchmarks that that's a strategy the state's used for an awfully long time. Where are we? Where we're going? That kind of a thing. One big part is the natural gas safety elements that are put into this bill. That's a reaction to the explosion in the Merrimack Valley of not that long ago. You know, sets new standards for, you know, making sure that gas lines are safe, they are inspected regularly, and that companies are not, you know, misusing the equipment that could potentially jeopardize customers or, you know, safety lines. It's going to be kind of a sea change over a long, long time. Where the governor has consideration on this and where he might disagree somewhat is not in the goals. It's simply on how fast and how to get there. So that's one thing that I think we're going to be, you know, looking at. Baker's plan has a little bit different percentages, a little bit, you know, more emissions, so to speak, than the Democrats' position that they put forward.
So he doesn't need to sign off on it, or he can't veto it?
The bill is on his desk. He cannot veto it. He can walk away from it and let the bill die. Lawmakers will then repass it over his veto down the road. It's a bit procedural, but Democrats have made their plan clear. And so, you know, Baker can stall a bit at this point in the session, but there isn't too much he can do.
Oh, I see. Okay. Finally, Mike, and just briefly, we only have a few seconds, but way back a long time ago, just before Christmas, you and I talked about rumors that House Speaker Robert DeLeo was going to leave Beacon Hill for a job at Northeastern, and you had a name for who might succeed him. And of course, DeLeo at the time denied it, but then the rumors have since come true. So I wanted to kind of close up that mystery that we had there a couple weeks ago.
DeLeo's denial was very lawyerly, as it was written. That is because he was most likely using third parties to find him a job. That's why this went so fast. Once that job with Northeastern was arranged, the speaker was kind of let in on it. He accepted it, and now he's gone. The House has moved on. They have selected DeLeo's number two, who is former Majority Leader Speaker Ron Mariano. He was elected last week, and then again this week as the new session was moving forward. So he is officially the speaker now for this 192nd meeting of the Great and General Court. So he is very similar to DeLeo in a lot of ways. He's seen as kind of stability, rooted in stability at this point, during a pandemic, during a time when the budget is still very erratic. So the 74-year-old Mariano from Quincy will be in charge. He does not have plans to stay in for 12 years like DeLeo did. There is some grumbling that he is just too moderate or even too conservative. However, it should be said that he got all those progressive Democrats to vote for him. So that's the status of the speakership right now.
We'll be talking with you next week, I'm sure, about the new legislative session that did start on Wednesday and what we can expect. That's State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you.
And that's CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. I'm Steve Junker. This is the News Roundup. This has been a major week for climate legislation in Massachusetts. Right now, a comprehensive climate bill is awaiting action on Governor Charlie Baker's desk, as we heard a little from Mike Dean. CAI's Eve Zuckoff has been reporting on what's in the bill, and she joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, we just heard a little bit about this from Mike, explaining it as a roadmap going forward. How would the average person feel or experience the changes laid out in this climate change bill?
Yeah, there are a number of different ways people will experience this. So first, the bill will change appliance standards. So don't worry, you don't have to get rid of your fridge or your washing machine or dishwasher. But when the time comes to buy new ones, you'll probably have to purchase higher efficiency models that could potentially cost more up front. We don't know that for sure, but they could. But they will lower your energy bills in the long run. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars of savings. We're also likely to see an increase in electric vehicles on the road, a lot more hybrid vehicles, which means you should see more charging stations at malls and municipal lots. And finally, this bill not only codifies environmental justice into law, kind of defining what it means and requiring tools for EJ communities, but it would prioritize low-income communities in SMART, the state's kind of primary solar incentive program, and the bill would put $12 million towards clean energy workforce development for minority and women-owned small businesses, environmental justice communities, and fossil fuel workers.
So this climate change bill is now on Governor Baker's desk. But in the meantime, many towns and cities not waiting around for it. New Bedford has just released its own climate action plan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so NB Resilient, as it's known, is this new 71-page plan. It's got a whole bunch of actions in it, and it establishes its own framework to rely exclusively on renewable energy, reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions, this should be sounding familiar, and become a zero-waste community all in the next 30 years. And to get there, the plan calls for a long-term adaptation strategy for the port. It seeks to reduce overall energy and water use, promotes electric vehicle adoption, citywide composting, and community solar projects. So really, there is a lot of overlap between what we see at the state and local levels.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff, our environmental reporter. Eve, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We spoke with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, and CAI's Mike Dean at the State House, and CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Thanks to our Dan Treidel back at the studio. He's the anchor holding fast to the ship of the News Roundup. And a big thanks this week to all the teachers across the region. They're doing heroic service, truly. As a parent, I am moved by what I see and overhear from my children's remote classrooms. Thank you, teachers. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.